Graphic Audio. A movie in your mind.
Graphic Audio presents William W. Johnstone, Smoke Jensen, the Mountain Man, 24, Guns of the Mountain Man. Narrated by Mort Shelby. With performances by James Lewis, Drew Copas, Tim Getman, Elizabeth Journey, David Coyne, James Konacek, Michael Glenn, Joe Brack, Stephen Carpenter, Tim Carlin, Richard Rowan, Paul Fidalgo, Dylan Lynch, Christopher Graybill, Andy Clements, Johann Detweiler, and Thomas Pitt. Calvin Woods rode out to the northern section of the Sugarloaf Ranch. He and Pearly, the foreman, had been stringing fence earlier, and Cal had plumb forgotten to load up the extra wire and tools when it came time to head back to the ranch house. Now, he was having to ride all the way back out there to pick up the tools, and he was giving Pearly first shot at the bear sign donuts Miss Sally was sure to have cooling in the kitchen.
Darn it all! By the time I get back, Pearly will have about near all them bear sign eaten up, Dusty. I'll be lucky if and we get more than one or two.
Cal's horse was the offspring of a cross between Joey Wells' big strawberry roan named Red and one of the Palouse mares Sally had given him and his wife a couple of years ago. The horse, called a Quicksilver Gray, was actually almost pure white, different from a true white albino by having blue eyes instead of pink. The bronc was a pale gray in front with snow-white hips, without that typical Palouse spot on its hindquarters. Cal had named him Dusty, and he'd formed a deep bond with the animal the first time he'd ridden. He found the tools where he'd left them and loaded them in a burlap sack, which he tied to the back of his saddle. Cal swung into the saddle and loosened the rawhide hammer thong on his colt as he rode toward the ridge. Lately, he'd taken to imitating his hero, Smoke Jensen, and he carried both a Winchester in his left saddle boot and a Greener 10-gauge double-barreled express gun in his right boot. Cresting the ridge, he pulled the shotgun from its scabbard and eared back the hammers as he reined his horse to a halt. Down the hill, he saw a group of about 15 or 20 men on horseback. Several of the riders were cutting a fat steer out of the herd while the others sat in their saddles watching. Cal was trying to decide whether he should ride down and brace the men alone or hightail it back to the ranch house and get some help. He did not particularly like the odds at 20-1, but he knew if he took the time to go for backup, the men might be gone by the time he got back there. His decision was made for him when one of the rustlers looked up and saw him sitting on the ridge. The man leaned over and spoke to a tall man wearing a black frock coat who turned to stare at Cal.
Hick. In for a penny, in for a pound, as they say. Howdy, gents.
Cal spoke to the tall man who appeared to be in charge. Up close, the galoot was even stranger looking than he had been from a distance. He appeared to be over 6.5 feet tall. He was skinny to the point of being gaunt, and he had a scraggly goatee covering his lips and chin. His eyes had a haunted, wild look as if there was nothing behind him, and he was dressed all in black, from his coat and vest to his pants and boots. His boiled shirt was the only spot of lightness about him. As he turned in the saddle, Cal could see he wore a Colt on each hip, and a Henry Yellow Boy rifle was resting across his thighs.
You men are aware you're trespassing on private property, aren't you?
What is your name, boy?
My name's Cal. What's yours?
Lazarus. Lazarus Cain. Have you been saved, Cal?
Saved from what?
Why, from hell and damnation, of course.
What's all this got to do with the fact you men are stealing my boss's cattle?
I don't like this young pup calling me thief, boss.
A young Mexican kicked his horse to ride up in front of Cal. He put his hand on his pistol butt.
Why don't I just kill him?
Anytime you think you're ready, cabrona.
The man went for his pistol.
We got you outnumbered 20-1, boy.
19-1 now, Mr. Kane. If in any more of your men get itchy trigger fingers, you'll be the next one I kill.
You're pretty brave sitting behind that shotgun, boy.
Like Mr. Cold said, God created all men equal. Only this here express gun makes them more equal than others. Now, I suggest you gentlemen ride on out of here, leaving the beeves you cut out of the herd behind.
As he finished speaking, Cal saw out of the corner of his eye a man start to raise a pistol. Before he could turn back, Lazarus drew his pistol. One slug took Cal in the left shoulder and the other in the right chest, shattering a rib and embedding itself deep within his chest.
You got a lot of sand, I'll say that for you, boy.
Cal's vision blurred, then it focused in time to see Lazarus do the strangest thing. He pulled out a Bible and he held it up, spreading his hands wide toward heaven.
Yea, as I walk through the valley of the shadow of death.
As the crazy man prayed, Cal noticed blackness creeping across the sky until it became a large dark hole which swallowed him up. After Cal lapsed into unconsciousness, Lazarus continued to pray for a few moments. When he finished, he noticed Dusty standing a short distance away from Cal. He pursed his lips, thinking. Then his eyes widened and a joyful expression came over his face. He walked his horse over and picked up Dusty's reins. Lazarus pulled the reins and led Dusty over to the group of men waiting to see what he would do next.
So I looked and behold a pale horse, and the name of him who sat on it was Death, and Hell followed with him, and power was given to them over a fourth of the earth to kill with sword, with hunger, with death, and by the beasts of the earth.
What the hell's that supposed to mean, Lazarus?
Blackie Jackson sat leaning forward in his saddle with his arms crossed over his saddle horn.
That, Blackie, for your information, is from the Bible, the book of Revelation, chapter 6, verse 8.
Yeah, boss, but, what's it mean?
Coming upon this young man with his pale horse is another sign from God that we are on the correct path. That we are indeed doing his bidding and will be rewarded with his blessings.
So you intend to take that white horse or what?
Yes, I intend to ride this pale horse, as the Bible said. And I will ride across a fourth of the country like death followed by hell, killing and doing God's work until he calls us home.
Whatever the hell you're gonna do, you better hurry up and do it. Them shots are liable to bring some more punchers on the run.
If anyone else comes, we will deal with them the same way we did this young man.
I, for one, don't mind fighting, but personally, I'd rather save my energies for when there might be a possibility of profit in the matter.
Well said, Blackie. Let's ride!
Smoke Jensen, legendary gunfighter, leaned against the wall of his cabin with his arms folded and watched his ranch foreman, Pearly, devour Sally's bear sign donuts as if he hadn't eaten for months. Sally, standing next to the kitchen table, wiped flour off her nose and shook her head. As many times as she'd seen Pearly eat, it still amazed her how much food that cowboy could put away. Standing just under 6 feet tall, Pearly weighed no more than 150 pounds, and he didn't have an ounce of fat on his body. His face was brown as mahogany and wrinkled from 20 years riding in the sun, and one could usually tell what he'd had for his last meal from the crumbs that accumulated in his handlebar mustache. He was a good foreman, and his hands were intensely loyal, in spite of the many practical jokes he played on them.
Pearly, Didn't you just have breakfast a few hours ago? Come again?
I said, I was running late this morning. I only got to eat 3 or 4 hen's eggs and a handful of bacon and 3 or 4 biscuits. It wasn't hardly enough to keep a body alive till noontime.
Oh, I see what you mean. I guess I'm going to have to talk to Cookie about keeping you men on starvation rations.
Pearly nodded, then he took the platter of bear sign and put him in the cabinet out of sight. He broke off a small piece of one and placed it in the middle of the table on a plate.
Pearly, what are you doing?
When Cal gets back here, all he's going to see is that little bitty piece of bear sign, and he's going to think I ate them all up. Boy, is he going to be mad.
Smoke walked out on the porch to finish his coffee. He smiled to himself, thinking back on how Pearly had come to work for him and the changes in the young man since that day. Pearly had come to work for Smoke in a rather roundabout way. He was hiring his gun out to Tilden Franklin in Fontana when Franklin went crazy and tried to take over Sugarloaf, Smoke and Sally spread. After Franklin's men raped and killed a young girl in the fracas, Pearly had sided with Smoke and the aging gunfighters he had called in to help put an end to Franklin's reign of terror. Pearly was now honorary foreman of Smoke's ranch, though he was only a shade over 20 years old himself. Boys grew to be men early in the mountains of Colorado.
Pearly!
Yes, sir?
I just heard what sounded like shots from the direction you and Cal were working in this morning. Is anybody else out in that section?
No, sir. The rest of the hands were over to the west, worming the new calves.
What's wrong, Smoke?
I don't know. I'm afraid Cal is in more trouble. Gunshots from the pasture where he's working. Sally, you get a buckboard and head out to the north pasture, where we have the Hereford crosses. Pearly and I'll ride on ahead to see what's happening.
All right.
And Sally, bring your medical kit and your pistol.
Smoke ran to the hitching post in front of the cabin where he and Pearly had their horses tied. He was riding a new 2-year-old stud Joey Wells had sent over from Pueblo, Colorado. Joey and his wife had bought the old Rockin' Sea Ranch after killing Murdoch, the man who owned it. Smoke and Sally gave him some Palouse mares to breed with Joey's big roan, which he called Red. Smoke stud was a blanket-hipped Palouse, roan-colored in the front with hips of snow white, without the usual spots of a Palouse. He'd named him Joker because of his odd color. Pearly also had one of the offspring of Red, a gray and white Palouse he'd named Cole. When Smoke asked him why he had named him that, Pearly said it was because the sucker was cold back in the morning and bucked for the first damn 10 minutes every day when Pearly saddled him up. In spite of this, both studs were beautiful animals and had inherited their father's big size and extreme strength and endurance, along with the Palouse's legendary quickness and intelligence. Smoke and Pearly leaned over the necks of their mounts and rode hell-bent for leather toward the pasture where Cal was. A short time later, Smoke was leaning over Cal's still body, holding a bandana soaked in water from his canteen, pressed tight against the boy's chest wound, as Sally arrived in the buckboard. Pearly's bandana was tied as a tourniquet around Cal's arm just below the shoulder, and it slowed the bleeding there to a trickle. Sally grabbed her medical bag from the seat next to her and jumped to the ground. She ripped Cal's shirt open to get a better look at his wound.
Oh, it's a lung wound. See how the blood on his lips is frothy and bright red?
Yes. Do you think there's any chance?
If we can stop the air in his lungs from coming out of the wound, it might allow his lungs to re-expand and keep him alive until Doc Spaulding can operate on him.
Sally glanced over her shoulder at the wagon she'd ridden in on. Pulling a clean white cloth from her medical kit, she handed it to Smoke.
Here, take this rag over to the wagon and smear axle grease from around the wheel bearings all over it. Put on a thick coat.
Smoke did what she said, then handed her the grease-covered cloth. Sally opened it up and slapped it over Cal's sucking chest wound. The grease had the added effect of slowing the blood from the wound, but even so, Cal was the color of flour.
He's lost a lot of blood.
You think he's able to make the trip into Big Rock?
We don't have any choice. If he is going to have any chance of survival at all, Doc's going to have to operate as soon as possible.
Smoke, looky here.
Smoke walked over and saw Pearly standing over Cal's saddle, lying on the ground. Nearby were two large pools of blood soaking into the soil.
It appears Cal put lead into at least two of them.
Yeah, and the bastard stole Dusty after they shot Cal.
As soon as Cal was breathing more normally, Smoke and Pearly lifted him up and put him in the back of the wagon. Pearly grabbed the reins and drove while Sally and Smoke sat in the back, trying to keep Cal from rolling around too much as they traveled over rough terrain. Once, Cal's eyes flicked open for a second. They were vacant, as if he really wasn't fully conscious.
Cal, it's Smoke. Who did this to you?
Ichabod. Ichabod Crane.
Smoke sat back, wondering what in the hell he meant. He glanced up to see Sally staring at Cal, too, tears in her eyes.
We can't let him die, Smoke.
Cal's too tough to die, Sally. He'll make it through this. I promise.
As the buckboard bounced and rocked over the uneven road toward Big Rock, Colorado, both Sally and Smoke prayed silently for their friend. Pearly, on the hurricane deck fighting the rains, was too busy to pray, but he was not too busy to cuss the men who'd had the gall to shoot his best friend, a man he considered closer than a brother. Pearly pledged he'd repay those who had done this to Cal if it was the last damn thing he ever did. As he rode, Lazarus enjoyed the feel of the pale horse underneath him. The animal was long through the croup, and thus he had an easy rocking chair gait. It was truly another sign from God that he was the chosen one, picked out of all the men on earth to spread God's word, and more importantly, to punish those evildoers who didn't obey his commandments. The easy motion of the bronc lulled Lazarus into a dreamlike state, and his mind roamed back to the day the Lord took him under his wing. It was just one of a thousand dirty little battles in the war between the states, not even important enough to have a name. The 6th Confederate Brigade from Arkansas was pinned down in the copse of woods, live oaks, maples, and birch mainly. It was the tail end of winter, and there were ragged patches of snow still on the ground, an area shadowed by trees or rocks. The young boy from Lizard Lick, Arkansas, was more frightened than he'd ever been in his life. Laz, as he was called by his friends, lay on his stomach in the soggy, frigid mud and prayed that God would let him live through this terrible day. Over half the men in his troop had been killed or wounded, and the fire from the Yanks on the hills above him was devastating and showed no signs of stopping. Another kid from his neck of the wood, Johnny Slater, was lying next to him in the muck.
I want my mom! I don't want to die!
Laz, whose father was a lay preacher in the Blood of the Sacred Lamb Pentecostal Church back home, planned to follow his father into the preacherhood. He scrabbled over to Johnny on his hands and knees, pulling out his Bible.
Johnny, pray with me for a minute, and God will get us through this.
Johnny had raised wide, bulging eyes to stare at Laz.
Get away from me, Laz! You're gonna draw the fire, you crazy bastard!
But Johnny, you've got to take the Lord by the hand, or we'll never survive this battle.
No! See? See? I told you you was gonna bring fire down on us with your damn yamping and Bible thumping, but nothing!
Johnny scrambled to his feet and lifted his musket out of the mud. He eared back the hammer and held the long rifle in front of him as he started running, low and bent over, toward a thicker group of trees 50 yards away.
Johnny, trust in the Lord!
Johnny paused and stood up to look back over his shoulder at last. And his eyes widened and his mouth opened in surprise as a bullet passed into his back and erupted out of his chest, taking a good part of his ragged gray tunic with it. The boy just stood there a moment, looking down at the hole in his chest as if he couldn't believe it. Then he glanced up reproachfully at Laz, just before he tumbled to lie face down in the soggy grass of the field. At the sight of the death of his friend from home, something snapped in Laz, and he jumped to his feet. He jammed his Bible into his breast pocket where his dad had told him to wear it over his heart and picked up his rifle.
Let's go kill those Yankee bastards! Kill every last one of the bastards!
Unmindful of the withering fire from the slopes and hillocks around them, Laz walked out of the woods and began to fire and reload again, all the while remaining miraculously unhit by musket balls and pistol bullets. Both shamed and inspired by this act of bravery, the men in Laz's troop jumped up and began to run at the Yankee troops dug into the hills around them. Men around Laz began to fall from the fire above, but he remained unhit, firing his musket until the barrel glowed a ruddy red and steam poured off of it. The sight of the rebel troops advancing into hellish fire, screaming and yelling like madmen, unnerved the Yanks, and one by one they began leaving their position and running away, looking back over their shoulders to see if those crazy Rebs were still coming. One of the last to leave took aim at the man leading the charge and fired. His ball took Laz in the chest and slammed him backward to land spread-eagled on his back in a patch of snow. Some of the men nearby walked over to stare down at Laz and almost fainted when he shook his head and sat up, a look of wonder on his face.
Laz, boy, you all right?
Laz put his hand to his chest and pulled his father's Bible out of his pocket. Embedded in it was the bullet meant to take Laz's life. At that moment, surrounded by dead and dying men, inhaling the stink of cordite and sulfur and blood and excrement, Lazarus Kane knew he'd been chosen by God for some important purpose.
God saved me, boys! He wants me to kill some more Yanks before I die!
Then they all turned to finish their attack, completely routing the superior Yankee forces that had pinned them down. After the battle, Lazarus Kane received a promotion and a commendation. Before the war was to end, he would make a colonel and lead his own troops into battle, always carrying that Bible with the bullet in it. After that traitor to the cause, Robert E. Lee, surrendered, Lazarus and his band of men continued to fight, raiding towns sympathetic to the Yankees, killing and pillaging, looting and burning, until there was no place in the country they could go without being hunted. They were wanted in virtually every state, and yet they continued to fight, even after forgetting what they were fighting for and who their enemy was. It became a way of life for him, and as his men got killed or captured, Lazarus replaced them with men equally bloodthirsty and dangerous. This thought brought him fully awake, and he looked around him at the men riding with him. On his right hand was his second in command, Blackie Jackson. 5'10" in height and weighing over 250 pounds of solid muscle, Blackie had hands like hams and arms thicker than most men's necks. He was an ex-blacksmith from a small town in Texas. He had come to ride with Lazarus after catching his wife with another man. He'd worked on that man's head like it was a horseshoe, and when he had finished with him, he had turned to his wife, sticking her head into the coal pit until it burned to ashes. He was a man who liked to fight with his hands, and he had never in his life been beaten. On Lazarus's left rode Tom, behind the deuces, Cartwright. An ex-gambler, Tom got his nickname from his habit of betting heavily at faro whenever he was dealt two deuces. Physically, he was a small man with a rat-like face and a pencil mustache, skinny of frame with greasy black hair that was thinning on top. Sensitive about his balding head, thinking he was a ladies' man, he rarely took his hat off. His favorite weapons were a Derringer two-shot 44 he carried in his vest and a knife hidden in his boot. Though for long range he used a Winchester rifle, he much preferred the Derringer, stating that he liked to see the look in a man's eyes when life left him. Behind Cartwright rode Curly Joe Ventrilo, of Italian descent with dark curly hair. He was 20 years old, and he was a favorite with girls and women of all ages, having a baby face that was considered very handsome. His good looks hid his propensity for heavy drinking and violence toward women. This began on the Owl Hoot Trail, after cutting up a prostitute's face when he couldn't perform one night after getting drunk. He soon discovered he liked rough sex and hurting females. and he repeated the act every chance he got. On the other side of the group was Pig Iron Carlton, ex-professional fisticuffs champion. He'd been running from the law since beating two men to death in a barroom brawl. Tall, muscular, he had hands and knuckles covered with scar tissue from his many bare-knuckled fights, so he couldn't hold a pistol that well. He favored a Winchester 44-40 rifle and sawed-off 10-gauge shotgun for close-in work. He wasn't particularly mean, and he only killed when forced to by circumstances. His cauliflower ears and the scar tissue around his eyes and his oft-broken nose made him look frightful, and no man dared laugh at his appearance. Right next to Carlton was Jeremy Brett, an Englishman relatively new to America. Jeremy's dress was very dapper, a bowler hat and a dark suit covered with a black duster while on the trail. Soft-spoken, he used a shoulder holster with a Smith & Wesson American Sheriff's Model 44 caliber pistol. No one knew why he'd chosen to ride the Al Hoot Trail, as he wouldn't speak of it, and he became extremely violent if pushed on the matter. The last of Lazarus's lieutenants was King Johansson, a big, fair-haired, blue-eyed Swede farmer from up in Minnesota. He was borderline mentally retarded. Though his mind was slow, he was very quick with his guns, and he could be very mean when he was upset, going into violent rages if crossed. At other times, he was like a little child, sweet and mild-tempered. He carried a shotgun on a sling around his shoulders and a long machete-type knife in a scabbard on his belt, the blade of which was rusty from the blood of his victims. He never wiped the sword-like instrument off after using it. There were another 15 or so men at any one time riding with Lazarus, each and every one as mean and dangerous as the next. They had no real plan and no real destination. The gang rode wherever they wanted and took whatever they needed. Lazarus had no compunction about killing anybody who crossed him. In his mind, he could do no wrong since he'd been personally chosen by God. If by chance he happened to kill an innocent man or a woman, he felt they would be rewarded by God and taken to heaven. He didn't have to feel guilt since he was sending them to a better place. On the other hand, if someone deserved to die, God had sent them to hell, and Lazarus was just doing God's work for him.
Hey, boss, looks like there's a town up ahead.
Lazarus glanced down at the weather-beaten sign next to the road.
Fontana? I don't remember a town by that name on the map.
Me neither, Lazarus.
Well, Tom, let's ride on in and see what this Fontana's like.
As they rode down the center of the town's main street, they were greeted by broken-down, rotting buildings and boardwalks that had definitely seen better days.
Damn, looks like a ghost town.
Nope, Joe.
Pig Iron pointed up ahead.
There's some horses outside that saloon.
Sure enough, there were three horses reined to a post in front of a saloon with a faded hand-lettered sign hanging askew over the door. It read, Dog Hole.
Sounds like my kind of place. Wonder if they've got a faro game.
Hell, I wonder if they got any whiskey. Place looks pretty run down.
The gang dismounted and walked into the saloon. A man behind the counter had a silver star on his chest and a dark top hat on his head. Lazarus, upon seeing the badge, placed his hand on his pistol butt.
Are you the local sheriff?
Hell yes. I'm the sheriff, the mayor, the dog catcher, and the bartender. In fact, I'm just about the whole damn town.
What's your name?
I'm Bob Blanchard. You men come on in and have a seat. There's plenty of whiskey and beer, though not much food.
You got any women?
Oh, yes. I got a couple.
Blanchard looked over his shoulder and then leaned forward.
They ain't much to look at, but they get the job done, if you know what I mean.
As he spoke, a woman walked out of a room upstairs and leaned over the railing, smiling a gap-toothed smile. She weighed at least 200 pounds, and her hair looked as if someone had pulled part of it out of her scalp.
They'll get the job done all right, after about a quart of whiskey, maybe.
I don't need no whiskey, at least not first, maybe later.
Curly Joe started up the stairs.
Curly Joe.
Yeah, boss?
I don't want any trouble. Not until we're ready to leave.
You understand me?
All right.
Lazarus turned to Blanchard.
Set up whiskey for all my men. You can tell me what happened to this town.
After Blanchard had set out bottles of whiskey on each of the tables, he leaned on the bar, absent-mindedly wiping it with a dirty rag as he talked.
The town was founded by a man named Tilden Franklin a number of years ago, after gold was discovered here. He named it after a Mexican girl he once knowed.
Gold? They discovered gold here?
Yeah, only most of this valley belonged to a man named Jensen, Smoke Jensen. And he didn't particularly care to have a bunch of miners running around on his land looking for gold.
So what happened?
Franklin brought in a gang of toughs. Some of the meanest men in several states came here to help him take the valley away from Jensen.
And did they?
Nah. Jensen called in a bunch of old gunfighters, men most people thought were long dead, and they had one of the biggest gunfights in history, right here in Fontana. Streets ran red with blood, I'm told.
Must have been something to see.
I guess. I wasn't here myself, but those who survived either left town or were carried out on boards.
Where did the ones who left go?
South, on down the road a ways, to a town Jensen started called Big Rock, Colorado.
And the gold?
Still here, I reckon. Since then, no one's had the courage to try and dig it out of the ground, because they know Jensen would be on them like ticks on a hound dog if and they did.
You don't say. Mr. Blanchard, do you have a telegraph in this town?
Yes, sir. I forgot to mention, I'm also the chief telegraph operator.
Sally felt Cal's pulse, a worried look on her face.
I don't like the way Cal looks, Smoke. I have a feeling you better ride on ahead and have Doc Spaulding ready to operate as soon as we get there.
Smoke didn't question Sally's expertise. She treated more bullet wounds than most doctors, and a good many of them on Smoke. He grabbed Joker's reins, which were tied to the rear of the wagon, and pulled the animal alongside. He didn't dare take the time to stop their progress toward Big Rock, so he jumped into the saddle from the rear of the buckboard. Smoke gave Sally a smile for encouragement. Then he leaned over Joker's head and spurred him into a full gallop toward town. Smoke rode into Big Rock as fast as that horse could run. As he passed the sheriff's office, Monte Carson stepped out the door and pushed his hat back on his head, watching Smoke race by, a quizzical look on his face. When Smoke reined up in front of Dr. Cotton Spaulding's office, Monty came running, knowing something bad had happened. Smoke jerked the door open, then stepped to the consultant room door. Restraining his first impulse to burst through the door, Smoke tapped lightly instead. After a moment, Cotton opened the door, his sleeves rolled up and a frown on his face.
What is it? Oh, I'm sorry, Smoke. Didn't know it was you.
That's all right, Doc. But Cal's been hurt real bad. Took a bullet in the chest and shoulder.
Oh.
Sally says to tell you it's in his lung, and he's lost a lot of blood. She says you need to operate as soon as they get here.
Well, if Sally says it, then it must be serious.
Cotton turned back into his consulting room. Smoke looked over his shoulder and saw a man bent over the table, his buttocks exposed and showing a bright red lump on one cheek.
Earl, I'm afraid I'm going to have to lance that boil later. I've got an emergency coming in.
Earl straightened up, looking angry.
Look here, Doc, I'm in pain, and I want this boil cut now. The other can wait his turn.
Cotton put his hand up in front of Smoke, who'd started through the door with his fist clenched.
Earl, I've got a young boy with two bullets in him, one in his chest. He's gonna die if I don't operate right away. Do you really want me to make him wait his turn?
Shamefaced, Earl lowered his gaze, his expression softening.
Oh. No, of course not, Doc. It's just this damn carbuncle is driving me crazy.
Cotton walked to the medicine cabinet and took out a small bottle.
Here, Earl, take this laudanum. Two sips every hour or so, you won't feel the pain. Come back in a couple hours, I'll fix you up permanently.
Earl pulled up his pants and took the bottle.
Oh, thanks, Doc. And I'm awful sorry about your friend, mister. I didn't mean nothing by what I said before.
Smoke nodded, tempted to smile in spite of the circumstances. Just then, Sheriff Monte Carson came into the office.
Hey, Smoke, what's going on?
Cal's been shot, Monte.
Is it bad?
About as bad as it can be, and him still be alive.
Any idea who did it?
He woke up long enough to say it was Ichabod Crane. but I don't know what he meant by that.
Ichabod Crane?
A character in a story by Washington Irving. Tall, skinny, with a prominent Adam's apple, as I recall.
You think that's what he meant, Smoke? Trying to describe the fella for us?
Possibly. But I'm more concerned with saving his life right now. I'll get to the man who did this after it's over, one way or another.
Monty nodded. He knew Smoke did not let anyone harm a friend of his, not without making him pay dearly for it.
Come on, Smoke. You can help me set up for the surgery.
I'll talk to you later, Monty.
Sure. Come on by the office. Meanwhile, I'll be going through some posters, see if I can find the galoot who did this.
Smoke walked into the consulting room, and Cotton led him through a rear door into his operating room. Surgery, as he called it. There were windows on every side of the room to let as much light in as possible, and two large lantern and sconces on each wall. In the middle of the room was a long table with a pad on it. There were straps for arms and legs for those occasions when it wasn't possible to give an anesthetic.
Smoke, fill that basin with carbolic acid and dump that tray of instruments into it, will you?
Carbolic acid? What's that for?
There's this man in Austria named Semmelweis who says the reason wounds get infected is due to contamination with small organisms called bacteria.
Smoke didn't look up as he filled the basin from a large bottle of liquid, turning up his nose at the strong, astringent smell.
I've never seen any small animals in wounds with pus, unless you're talking about maggots.
No, these organisms are too small to be seen with the naked eye. You need a microscope. Anyway, Semmelweis says if doctors would wash their hands and instruments in carbolic acid and wash wounds with soap and water, it would cut down on the number of infections and save a lot of lives.
And you believe him?
I don't know. Some of the other doctors in Austria say the man is crazy. But my feeling is it can't hurt, so why not give it a try? I do know that since I've been doing it, I haven't had a single wound separation following surgery.
Smoke heard the buckboard pulling up outside the office.
Better get your hands washed, Doc. Here they come.
Smoke and Pearly carried the unconscious Cal into the surgery and laid him on the table. Sally began stripping his clothes off.
You men go on outside. I'll stay and help Cotton with Cal.
Put the clothes sign on the door, will you, Smoke? That way we won't be interrupted.
All right. We'll get Monty to go on over to Longmont's for some coffee. You can reach us there if anything happens or you need us.
As soon as they left, Cotton washed his hands in the weak solution of carbolic acid and had Sally do the same. Then he laid out his instruments on a side table next to where Cal lay unconscious, his breathing labored, bloody froth on his lips. Sally had stripped him to his waist and positioned herself next to the instruments, ready to assist in the surgery.
Scalpel, please.
After Sally placed the razor-sharp knife in his hand, Cotton bent low over the table, and he made an incision horizontally over the entrance wound of the bullet in his chest.
I'll work on the chest wound first, since that's the most dangerous.
After opening the incision wider, he took a long, blunt-tipped probe and used it to follow the path of the slug, being gentle so as not to cause any more bleeding than was necessary. Cal was so deeply asleep that he didn't move when the probe was inserted. After a few moments of this, Cotton looked up.
It's as I feared when I saw the froth on his lips. The slug is embedded in his right lung. Luckily, from the depth the probe went in, it doesn't appear to be deep in the lung, but just on the edge. I suspect hitting the rib slowed the bullet up enough so it couldn't penetrate any further.
Taking the scalpel again, he lengthened the incision even more and used a claw-like tool to spread Cal's ribs apart. Using blunt dissection, he followed the path of the bullet to where it lay against the lining of the right lung. After about an hour of painstaking dissection, he felt the metal object with the tip of his scissors, doing most of his work by touch since he couldn't see the bottom of the wound. Sally handed him some long, narrow-tipped forceps, and he plucked the bullet out, placing it in a metal basin. Using gauze he first dipped in the carbolic acid, he stuffed the wound full and used bandages to hold it tight and compress it so as to stop the bleeding and close the hole in the lung, allowing it to re-expand. Next, he gave his attention to the shoulder wound, and he was happy to find the bullet had passed cleanly through the flesh, missing Cal's arm bone. Cleansing the wound as best he could, he packed it with gauze and wrapped a tight bandage around the entire arm. Finally, Exhausted and dripping with perspiration, he stepped back from the table and sleeved sweat off his face and forehead.
Well, now it's in God's hands. I've done all I can.
Sally slumped against the table, as tired as Cotton was.
You did a great job, Cotton. No one could have done more.
Lewis Longmont was sitting at his usual table playing solitaire when he saw Smoke and Pearly and Monty walk through the bat wings. Noticing the serious expressions on their faces, he signaled a waiter.
Johnny, bring a pot of coffee and three more cups to the table.
The young black man nodded and moved to the kitchen. Lewis got to his feet and held out his hand to Smoke. They'd been friends for a long time.
You look worried, my friend.
Cal's been shot, Lewis. Bad shot.
Is he?
No. Doc and Sally are working on him right now.
Lewis sat him at his table and poured coffee all around.
I offered Smoke and Pearly some coffee at my office, but for some reason they wanted to come over here.
Has that pot in your office ever been cleaned, Monsieur Monty?
Of course. 2 years ago, I believe it was.
Did you find any papers on the man Cal described?
Well, there were several that could have been, but none have been reported in this neck of the woods. About the nearest one I saw was a man named Lazarus Kane. He and his gang did some raiding down in Arkansas recently, but there was no mention of his heading this way.
Well, if this Kane has decided to pay us a visit and did this to Cal, he's gonna wish he never left Arkansas.
It was over 2 long hours before the solemn group gathered in Longmont's saloon heard any news from the doctor. Longmont had tried cheering him up by ordering a special meal from his French chef Andre, but in spite of the wonderful food, they all just picked at their plates with no real enthusiasm. Even Pearly, who could normally eat his weight in foodstuffs, barely tasted the roast duck with orange sauce and fried potatoes with sliced tomatoes and peach halves. When Sally came through the bat wings, they were all on their feet, asking questions at the same time. Exhausted and looking like she hadn't slept for days, she flopped down at the table.
Oh, Cal made it through the surgery, though it was scary going for a while. Dr. Spaulding says he's in God's hands now. But that Cal is young and healthy and has a lot going for him.
He's gonna make it. That boy's had plenty of experience with getting shot, and he's tough as no boot. He'll be all right. I just know it.
Did he wake up at all, Sally? Was he able to say any more about who shot him?
No. He didn't even move when Doc made his incision. Doc says he's in a coma from shock and loss of blood.
Seeing she was on the verge of breaking down, Smoke put his hand over hers on the table.
Come on, Sally. Let's go home. Doc will let us know how he does.
If it's all right with you, Smoke, I'll just hang around here for a while. Make sure Doc don't need nothing. Well, I can watch Cal while he tends to his other patients.
Sure thing, Pearly. That'd be very nice. And I know that when Cal wakes up, he'll be glad to see a friendly face by his side.
Friendly? Hell, I'm a box his ears for letting himself get shot without me there to take care of him. If I've said it once, I've said it a dozen times. That boy's a magnet for lead.
I'm gonna wire the surrounding sheriffs and see if anyone's had any trouble lately with any tall, skinny galoots, or if they heard of this Kane fella. I'll get in touch with you at the Sugarloaf if I hear anything.
Don't bother, Monty. As soon as we get the ranch house shut up, Smoke and I'll be back in town to sit with Cal until he's better.
Yes, and we'll take a room at that hotel.
Nonsense. I won't hear of it. You and Sally will stay at my place on the edge of town. I have a spare bedroom, and the food is guaranteed to be better than the hotels.
A year or so back, tired of living in hotels, Lewis had bought a widow's house on the outskirts of town. It was bigger than he needed, but he said he was tired of looking at the same four walls all the time. He wanted some room to roam around in when he wasn't at the saloon. Since then, he'd fixed it up really nice, with an extra bedroom for guests and a place in the back where his cook lived. Smoke showed up at Lewis's house around 9 that night.
Sally's going to sit with Cal for a while. I'm supposed to pick her up at 10 o'clock.
Come in and make yourself at home, Smoke. Would you like some coffee?
Sure. It's been a hell of a long day.
Later on, they sat around the table drinking coffee.
Did Monty hear anything back on his wires?
Not as far as I've heard. He said he probably wouldn't hear anything for a day or two. How are you doing, pal?
Not too well, Lewis. Since our children have been over in Europe for the past 2 years with Sally's father, Cal and Pearlie have been like sons to us. Now, with the prospect of maybe losing one, Sally and I are really worried.
Like the doc said, Cal's young and tough. I'm sure he'll pull through.
But I keep blaming myself for letting him go out there alone. Someone should have been with him.
Nonsense, Smoke. Cal's a grown man, and this is a tough country. Like you always say, a man's got to saddle his own horse and kill his own snakes.
You're right, of course. Whatever Cal got into out there on the Sugarloaf, he was ready and willing to do it. I figure the first shots I heard were his.
Did you find any bodies?
No, but there was a hell of a lot of blood, and it was scattered over too large an area to be all Cal's. I think he got at least one, maybe two, before they took him down.
So there must have been several men he was facing, if there were enough left after losing two for the others to cart off the bodies.
That's the way I figure it.
If that's true, then Cal must have drawn on them knowing the odds were heavily against him.
There never was any backup in Cal. That boy would bow his back and face down the devil himself if it ever came to that.
Kind of like someone else I know.
Lazarus Kane was sitting at the table he'd appropriated as his own in the Dog Hole Saloon. His chair was in a corner, so he had walls on both sides at his back and an unobstructed view of the bat wings that served as an entrance to the bar. It had been 2 weeks since he and his gang had settled in Fontana, and he was now the acknowledged leader of the town that was only a few citizens away from being a ghost town. Bob Blanchard, the man who'd been top dog here until Lazarus arrived, had accepted his new role as servant to Lazarus and his men without complaint, figuring it was a smart thing to do, and necessary if he were going to go on breathing.
Bob, bring me and the boys another round over here.
As Bob brought another bottle of whiskey to the table, he stopped for a moment.
Mr. Kane, one thing I can't figure out.
Yeah, what's that, Bob?
Well, the boys all say you're a holy man of sorts, having been called by the Lord to do his work.
Yes.
Well, how is it you drink so much whiskey and beer? Doesn't the good book speak out against such things?
Blackie Jackson cast a worried glance at his boss, wondering just how he would take this question. Lazarus's moods were hard to predict. One time he'd laugh and throw his arm around someone. The next, he was as likely to draw his Colt and put a bullet in the offended man's head. This time, Blanchard was lucky. Lazarus was in a forgiving mood.
Bob, I'll refer you to the good book, 1 Timothy chapter 5, verse 23.
Mr. Kane, I ain't exactly on speaking terms with the Bible. I'm not familiar with that particular verse.
It says, no longer drink only water, but use a little wine for your stomach's sake and your frequent infirmities.
Oh, wine?
Yes, and since they didn't have Kentucky bourbon in those days, I'm sure the Lord would have included it if there had been any around to drink. The point is, the Lord recognized a man sometimes needs a little alcohol to soothe him when life begins to get too much to handle.
Thanks for clearing that up. I'll have to remember that particular verse so as I can quote it if and someone ever tries to make me quit drinking.
Oh, perish the thought, Bob. Perish the thought.
After Blanchard walked off to stand behind the bar and await further orders, Blackie leaned back in his chair and gave Lazarus an appraising glance. Since he seemed to be in one of his good moods today, he figured he'd ask again about what the rest of the boys had been wondering about.
Say, Lazarus, when you gonna tell us what you got planned and why we've been stuck here in this two-bit excuse for a town for the past 2 weeks?
I've decided to stay around here and do a little gold mining.
Gold mining?
From what I hear, that Jensen fellow's land is absolutely brimming with gold. Word is, it's so thick over there, you don't even have to dig in some places. It's just lying around on the ground waiting to be picked up.
But boss, we ain't miners. What the hell made you decide this?
Spreading the Lord's word is expensive, Blackie. That's why we've been having to spend too much of our time raising money by rustling and robbing the occasional bank. If I can make one big score, get me enough money to last the rest of my life,
Then I can devote all my energies to doing the Lord's work. I might even open me up a church somewhere. One like my pappy used to preach at.
Blackie nodded, knowing it would do no good to try to talk Lazarus out of his scheme once his mind was made up. But there were other things to worry about.
What about this Jensen fellow? Blanchard said the last guy that tried to take the gold had 20 or 30 men and got plumb wiped out.
Well, I know. It won't be easy, especially since Jensen's built that town of Big Rock and has all the citizens in it behind him.
So you think the 20 of us can pull it off, tree the town, and get the gold before the U.S. Marshals or the Army finds out about it and sends in the troops?
No, no, no. 20 of us can. So I've wired for some help.
Oh?
Yes. I've sent for some special men who once rode for the Yellow and Gray. Men who didn't quit when the traitor General Lee surrendered. Men who kept fighting the good fight.
Well, who's that, boss?
Men who rode with Bloody Bill Anderson, Quantrill's Raiders, and Merrill's Marauders.
I heard Bloody Bill and his men got pretty well shot up a year or so back. Word is that Bloody Bill was shot in the head by Marshal Wyatt Earp and some other galoots over in Dodge City.
Yes. And do you know who was mixed up right in the middle of that little fracas?
No.
It was this same Jensen. Smoke Jensen that practically wiped out Bloody Bill and his men.
The ones that survived are thirsty for revenge.
But I heard they was all put in jail in Dodge and due to be hanged.
They were, till one of their other gang members snuck into town one night and, while Wyatt was busy dealing faro over at the Oriental Saloon, broke him out.
Oh, yeah?
Yeah. They hightailed it up into a little town a couple of hundred miles from here, called Sweetwater, Colorado.
How do you know all this?
I heard it from a man at the last trading post where we took on supplies. He was run out of town by some of the outlaws. He was pretty mad about it. Said he was going to tell the first marshal he ran across where they were hiding out.
So them are the ones you sent the wires to?
Yes. And a few others scattered around the territory who might be interested in some gold that's just lying around for the taking.
When do you think they'll be getting here?
Lazarus peered over Blackie's shoulder and then drained the last of his whiskey in one long swallow. Lazarus pointed out the window.
Right about now, I suspect.
Blackie looked over his shoulder and saw a group of four men riding up. They were wearing dusters and hats that were covered with trail dust. Lazarus stood up.
Time to meet our new partners, boys.
Four men walked through the bat wings, hands on pistol butts as they surveyed the room. One of the men, a youngster who looked no older than 17 or so, walked with a pronounced limp. His face lit up with a smile when he saw Lazarus, and he hobbled over to shake his hand.
Howdy, Lazarus.
Hello, Floyd. How's the leg?
Stiff, and it hurts like hell when the Northerners come through.
Lazarus shook his head in sympathy, then shook hands with the other men.
It's sure good to see you, boys. It's been a long time since we all rode with Quantrill.
Lazarus turned to his men, seated at several tables in the corners of the room.
Men, let me introduce you to some boys that know how to fight. This here is Floyd Devers. He's still carrying a bullet Smoke Jensen put in his right leg. The others are Walter Blackwell, Tad Younger, Cole's cousin, and Johnny Sampson. These are the last of Bloody Bill's gang.
Lazarus's men crowded in close and shook hands all around with the outlaws.
Mr. Blanchard, more whiskey for these men. They need something to wash the trail dust out of their throats.
After Floyd and the others all had bottles and glasses full in front of them, Lazarus sat at their table.
Floyd, tell me about what happened that day Bloody Bill got killed.
Floyd took a long drink of his whiskey and wiped his mouth with the back of his sleeve. Then he began to talk in a low voice as if he didn't particularly like to relive those hours. He chronicled the story of how he got a bullet in his leg while Bloody Bill and what remained of his gang galloped off, leaving him to face the notorious Smoke Jensen.
What happened next, Floyd?
Well, when I saw Pete Woods hit whilst trying to get me out of the water, and then Bill and the others ride off into the darkness, I knew I was done for. I managed to crawl and swim to the bank and put my leg up on a rock so the bleeding would slow down. After about 10 minutes or so, this real tall galoot riding in with another younger man, about my age, comes crossing the Cimarron as cool and unconcerned as if he were out for a ride to enjoy the evening air. He says his name's Smoke Jensen, and he proceeds to take his bandana off and wrap it around my leg, tying it down real tight.
Why didn't he just finish you off right then?
Don't rightly know. It's sure what Bill would have done. Anyways, he tells me to get on over to Dodge City and give myself up to Marshal Wyatt Earp, because he's going to go on after Bill and the others.
And he expected you to do that?
Yep. He said if and he got back to Dodge and I wasn't there, he'd hunt me down and kill me.
Did you believe him?
Damn straight! That's why I agreed to join this little party of yours. I've been looking over my back ever since I broke out of jail, just knowing he was going to be standing there someday, looking down at me over the sights of his colt. I gotta finish this with Jensen one way or the other so I can quit watching my back trail.
I can't believe you just walked on back to Dodge City and asked Marshal Earp to put you in jail because you was afraid of Jensen.
Floyd gave Blackie a look.
Just wait, Big Mouth. Soon you'll be facing Jensen with those eyes that look like they're made of ice, and we'll see how big you talk then.